This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
I'm Charles Payne.
I'm Martha McCallum.
I'm Greg Jarrett, and this is the Fox News Rundown.
Friday, March 29th, 2024. I'm Chris Foster. As the Supreme Court considers abortion pill restrictions, our latest Fox poll finds more Americans supporting abortion access.
But I think the more that people have the perception that abortion rights are under threat, the more they're going to answer these polls with, we think it should be legal, we think it should be accessible.
We're speaking with Fox News Sunday host Shannon Bream.
And Lisa Brady. More and more people are rejecting organized religion at a time when many are also searching for purpose.
There should be inspiration there. There should be say, come, because we're going to help you make you and your family better off. You're going to have a better life because of this.
And I'm Robert Jeffress. I've got the final word on the Fox News Rundown.
The Supreme Court heard arguments this week about rolling back expanded access to mifepristone, one of two drugs administered for medication abortions.
FDA-approved abortion by mail based on data it admitted was, quote, not adequate.
Attorney Aaron Hawley represents a group of conservative medical associations and anti-abortion doctors.
The lower court's decision merely restored longstanding and crucial protections under which millions of women used abortion drugs.
Solicitor General Elizabeth Prelogar arguing on behalf of the United States government.
Rolling back FDA's changes would unnecessarily restrict access to mifepristone with no safety justification. Some women could be forced to undergo more invasive surgical abortions. Others might not be able to access the drug at all.
Justice Sonia Sotomayor.
The reality is, even if there is some increase in emergency room visits, the question of when that rises to a sufficient safety risk is up to the FDA.
The pill is used in nearly two-thirds of all abortions in the U.S., and the Food and Drug Administration says it's safe.
This whole issue of standing, whether this group of pro-life doctors who brought the case, they're even the right plaintiffs for the case.
Fox News Sunday and Living the Bream podcast host Shannon Bream.
There were a lot of questions posed over and over again, like what is their harm? What is their injury? What can they show that, you know, illustrates they've been impacted in some way and actually have some harm that this court can then remedy for them? So I don't even think they get to it on the merits, but even on the merits, there was plenty of skepticism across the bench about second guessing the FDA and whether the FDA had done things correctly. Because here again, it's not pulling mifepristone from the market completely. It's about changes that the FDA made in 2016 and 2021 that allow greater access to the drug, rolling back some of the safety guidelines.
Yeah, the defense raised the point. Look, if the courts can throw out FDA approvals, then that's going to deter drug development. Well, why should I spend this money on R&D if its distribution is going to be curtailed down the road? It's a common question. Like, what's for experts to decide versus the courts versus legislation?
Yeah, and I do think the court has a couple of other things this term that will get to those questions about how much you defer to an executive agency versus should the court be making decisions. That was a question that came up a couple of times with Justice Jackson saying, you know, how do you feel about that, that it would be a court second guessing a pharmaceutical company or an agency like the FDA, who that's what their experts and doctors and researchers do all day. Now, a number of times during the arguments, the government's position and also Danko, which is the company that makes the drug, they argued that there just wasn't enough evidence of adverse actions to curtail the security or the safety issues. They're saying, listen, the evidence shows that it was fine to roll these back. But one of the things that happened in 2016 was the FDA said prescribers no longer had to report adverse incidents unless they were actually fatal. So people having, you know, severe bleeding, infections, ending up in the emergency room, those things don't get reported anymore. So to stand before the court and say there's not a lot of evidence of these things happening, when we know at 2016 they rolled back the requirement that you report a lot of those things, that had some skepticism for people. Yeah.
Medical professionals can't be forced to perform abortions or have anything to do with abortions legally under federal law. Some interesting questions to me out of the questioning. How far does that go?
Right.
Can you treat a woman who comes in with bleeding? You don't know if it's from a miscarriage or an abortion, first of all. Can you hand a woman a glass of water? What constitutes aiding an abortion.
Yeah, and there was a lot of pressing on that because there's another abortion case coming this year that will get more directly at that question, what doctors have to do in an emergency situation. And, you know, several of the doctors who were involved with this case submitted testimony saying, like, listen, when a woman is in the emergency room, she's bleeding, we're immediately going to jump in to try to save her life. We don't know a lot of times when we scrub in and get ready for these procedures, whether we are helping her with a terrible miscarriage, whether this is something that's mifepristone, an abortion that wasn't completed, and we're now going to be in the place of having to complete it. But again, a number of the justices said, you know, what are the odds that you're actually going to be in that situation? You happen to be the doctor on call in the emergency room. There's nobody else who can jump into the situation. That's where a lot of the skepticism came in for whether these doctors had real standing to show, like, the odds that a woman takes the pill, the odds that she has a bad reaction, the odds she ends up in your emergency room, the odds that there's not another doctor who can handle this. They didn't seem to be buying the argument that these doctors were suffering a real injury.
The Comstock Act, 1873, which I didn't know as much about yesterday as I do today, some anti-abortion activists referenced that it bans the mailing of anything considered obscene. Now, in the statute, it says that includes anything designed or adapted for abortions. So how is it legal to basically ship anything used by abortion facilities?
Yeah, this came up a couple of times. It was primarily Justice Thomas who was pressing on this question, like, why have we not fully addressed this? Now, the government made some arguments suggesting that it didn't apply here. It was a little tougher for the drug manufacturer when their attorney got up to deal with it. It didn't seem like there was a huge appetite, though, for the court to wade into this. You know, there were arguments that it hasn't been applied in 100 years or more. That it wouldn't apply here. But Justice Thomas was very much on that point about Comstock, and he went back to it repeatedly. But if it's only him and not at least, you know, four or five other justices, it won't matter.
Finally, look, there's a new Fox poll on abortion. Support for legal abortion is up since the Roe versus Wade reversal. A majority in this poll even opposes a 15-week ban, which is a little surprising to me. And again, mm-hmm. this is going to be something that's going to be played up by Democrats, not just this year, but in elections for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, and it's interesting when you do start to ask people about the timelines, it does change their perception some. But if the discussion, you know, that people keep trying to pin down Trump, are you going to do a nationwide abortion ban? And what would it be? Would it be 15, 16 weeks? Like, he keeps saying he's trying to find the sweet spot to keep all sides happy. It probably won't make anybody happy. You know, it's certainly not going to bring everybody together on this conversation and solve it. But I think the more that people have the perception that abortion rights are under threat, the more they're going to answer these polls with, we think it should be legal, we think it should be accessible. But when you press people on things about viability, about the government paying for it, your tax dollars paying for it, that's where you start to see more of a split for people. But yeah, I think following Roe v. Wade, most people's inclination, if they're sort of neutral or leaning to the left on this position, is we got to double down on protecting it because it's going away.
Joe Lieberman died. Always nice to meet a few times I talked mm-hmm. to him and met him. I assume he was always nice to you, too. Any memories mm-hmm. about him? Any thoughts on his legacy?
Yeah, I mean, so, so kind and truly devout when it came to his faith. We saw that. You know, demonstrated all the time the way that he operated on Capitol Hill, a very observant Jewish man and family, and just so devoted to his family. And we just saw that oozing from him all the time, this kindness, this genuineness, the integrity that people on both sides of the aisle trusted him. And I remember during 2020 when Justice Barrett was in the midst of her confirmation hearings. And there was a lot being said about her faith as a Catholic and was she extremist and all this kind of stuff. And he came out as a Jewish man and said, you know, he wanted to defend her. He thought it was very inappropriate that people were attacking her over her faith. And he was very defensive of her. And it was just a very kind, consistent thing coming from him where they may not have shared the same faith or maybe even the same, you know, viewpoints politically or anything else, but that he was coming to her defense. I mean, that just is one kind of example of the guy he was in Washington, increasingly rare.
I don't know if you have any occasion to try to be in Baltimore in the foreseeable future or soon. This Maryland Bridge closure, is this possibly a chance for President Biden, who talks about infrastructure a lot, and his Transportation Secretary, Pete Buttigieg, is this maybe a chance for them to shine a little bit?
It really could be. I mean, to step up, because this is such a tragic event on so many levels. I mean, we believe 6 lives lost. You know, just the devastation of that, but knowing this major transportation highway, which will complicate things. The port is, you know, it's compromised at this point. This could be really a moment where, listen, Secretary Buttigieg has taken a lot of heat that he hasn't done a lot of serious substantive stuff. This could be a great place for him to step up, for the White House to step up. You know, you heard the president saying, we're going to just jump in there and pay for this. Even when pressed, like, well, okay, if it's the ship or the company's fault, shouldn't they be paying for it? He's like, you know, we'll figure that out later. We're not going to hesitate to step in and get this done. You know, it's a much different situation, but people think about in the wake of a devastating hurricane down in Florida, where Governor DeSantis stepped up and got bridges rebuilt and things done in record time. I mean, tragedies can really be a chance for people to prove themselves, that they're up to the task. In an election year, that may be a very good thing for this White House.
Finally, Shannon, Evan Gerskovich, Wall Street Journal reporter, mm-hmm. has now been in Russian custody for a year, a year today. Any signs of hope for his friends and family?
Well, and now there's been another extension of his detention, waiting for a trial, waiting for something. You know, Putin has talked about that there could be a prisoner swap in the offing, but we don't seem to be, you know, at least publicly seeing real evidence of that moving forward. His family is speaking out, talking about just how incredibly difficult this is. It's been good to me to see that our ambassador has been able to visit him in prison, that he is having access so that people can get eyes on him, know that he's safe, that he's okay. He is in one of the worst prisons there that is designed to break down political prisoners and opponents and that kind of thing. So what a strong, brave person that he is walking through this a year into it with no trial date in sight, with no end in sight. I can only hope that he is getting the message about how many people are fighting to try to get him home, including the president.
Shannon Bream, Fox News Sunday host, Leaving the Bream podcast host. Shannon, talk to you later. Thanks.
Thank you, Chris.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
Hey there, it's me, Kennedy. Make sure to check out my podcast, Kennedy Saves the World. It is 5 days a week, every week. Download and listen at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.
This is Robert Jeffress with your Fox News commentary. Coming up.
While millions of Americans celebrate Easter this weekend, prepare to celebrate Passover in April or mark the Muslim holy month of Ramadan, they're actually part of a shrinking religious population, while the non-religious segment keeps growing. Nearly 1 in 3 Americans say none when prompted about their religion in an Associated Press NORC Center survey.
I think it's just no longer relevant. I mean, that's what you really find with the people that are non-verts.
Non-verts, a term author Stephen Bullivant uses to describe people who used to be religiously affiliated. But Karen Campbell, who's agnostic, says non-religious doesn't always mean non-believers.
They may believe, but, you know, they just, it's inconvenient to go to church. It's inconvenient to do it. So they just don't. And, it, you know, there's no reason why they should. They have better things to do.
A Gallup poll released this week finds only 3 in 10 U.S. adults attend religious services regularly. 20 years ago, it was 42%. Political scientist Ryan Burge is also a pastor in Illinois.
When I see the line graph pointing downwards, it's not just a line graph. It's what I've seen every single Sunday of my life the last 16 years is went from 50 to 40 to 30 to 20 to 10.
He says in 1972, only 5% of Americans identified as atheist, agnostic, or nothing in particular. That has jumped to 30%, and it's higher among the youngest adults. But does that mean people are less faithful?
So faithful, meaning filled with faith, right? So in other words, does church attendance, like, is that the same as do I believe?
Theologian Jonathan Morris is a Fox News contributor.
I would say it's not exactly, it's not a perfect equivalent, but yes, it definitely means when I am filled with faith, I'm more likely to attend church services, right? Except in maybe some circumstances. But I would say, yes, we are losing faith. We are losing faith. And what does that mean? It means we're losing faith in the divine, in the supernatural, in what happens after life, and also the consequences for our behaviors here and now.
What's driving that? Are there multiple reasons for that?
Great question. I would say, number one, there were reasons given to people to attend church and to believe in the past that were based on fear. And that's not a healthy, long-lasting explanation. So in other words, if you don't go to church, you're going to hell. That was very prevalent in the Catholic Church. It still is, like, I would say, from an objective, like, theological teaching. If you don't go to church, it's a moral sin on a Sunday. That people don't believe that, right? Is God going to condemn me to hell if I don't go to church on a Sunday because of my own laziness or whatever it is? Most people don't believe that. So if you give that reasoning, it's not going to really land in people, right? In people's mind and their own consciousness. So that's one thing. I think bad reasoning. Secondly, inspiration from leadership. There should be inspiration there. There should be say, come, because we're going to help you make you and your family better off. You're going to have a better life because of this. You're going to be more engaged in things that matter. You will have purpose. You will have mission. And certainly purpose and mission are something that are lacking deeply in society today. Let me give you the third reason. I don't think we make it as a religious community very easy for people to go to church. Let me give you a very personal example. I have a 2.5-year-old and a 6-month-old. I used to be a Catholic priest, as you know, and a lot of our audience knows. For many years, I was a Catholic priest. I don't think I did a good enough job welcoming families to say, come and be here and receive spirituality inspiration while we take care of your kids and give them some faith as well. A lot of evangelical churches do this better. Sunday school, childcare, etc. But as a whole, as a community in the United States of America, I think we could make church a better experience for young families.
I want to seize on the word community for a moment as well, because I was reading an article in The Atlantic that takes a deeper dive on this, and it referenced a book called The Great Dechurching. And it argues basically that more than anything else, we've let life and work get in the way. And there's a lot of emphasis on individual success rather than community. That doesn't seem like a shift that's easily reversible, though. Is it possible to start changing that?
Oh, that's a great question. I don't think those are concepts that, like, say, oh, we really should be in community now. I think I start going to church. No, I don't think so. It's more like, I need purpose. I need mission in my life. And maybe community can give that. But here's another aspect to this. In countries, in societies, in regions, even in continents where there's great suffering rather than prosperity, church attendance and religiosity, spirituality are much higher, right? So in parts of the world where there is deep suffering, people run to find purpose and mission and meaning in life through religion. In the United States of America, we, even with all of our problems, there is great prosperity, relatively speaking. And when there's great prosperity, we forget that we are not self-reliant. And I can tell you why we're not self-reliant, because there are no U-Hauls following hearses to the gravesite. Nobody can bring anything with them. We cannot take what we are building up on this earth in our families and our lives to the grave. It doesn't work. We know that. But when there's prosperity in our lives, we can sometimes forget and think that, hey, I'm actually self-sufficient. I don't need anything, including from God.
Are you surprised that the pandemic, you know, didn't send more people toward faith instead of away from it. I mean, obviously, shocking world events like that can really shake someone's faith. Many houses of worship were streaming services during lockdown. What do you say to people who've had those kinds of feelings and doubts creep in?
Yeah, so all the data shows that the pandemic or endemic of COVID-19 did drive people to make life-changing decisions. Actually, marriage was up. Long-term commitments were up. I'll give you an example. I got married during the pandemic. And that all of that like change in our daily life activities made us rethink some of the things that we cared about most deeply. But I would say the church, and I say the church, the Catholic Church, the Evangelical Church, the Protestant churches, mainline Protestant churches, really lost out on an unbelievable opportunity to bring people back to God and to religion, because many of them followed what I would say blindly government information and mandates to shut down. And there should have been a much stronger, I would say, creative way to say, we're going to still gather and we're going to worship God. And we're going to do that in person, also online for those who were at great risk. But no, we're not going to shut the churches. Think of a, you know, there's so many large churches. You could have had social distancing, which who knows if that actually made a difference in the end anyway. But there could have been social distancing. We didn't have to shut the churches down. When people most needed faith, the church, I would say as a whole, I think failed us, or we failed the people in many ways. And I think it's something that is very present on the minds of church leadership now, and I think would never happen again.
There's a movement of nonverts, people turning to secular spiritualism, away from organized religion, away from belief in God, per se. Does this just give a name to something that's already been happening, or do you think it signals a larger shift?
Oh my gosh, that's so interesting, because secular spiritualism, I think, are the words that you use, which I think is really interesting, because that's some of the language that is used. And so I'm glad you bring it up in that way. But secular spiritualism, so secularization has to do with taking God out of our lives. And spiritualism or spirituality has to do with the fact that we actually connect with or believe in something beyond the here and now, the physical, right? Spiritual, something that is divine, something that is bigger than ourselves. But it doesn't really make sense. The fact that I'm not religious doesn't take away the fact that I'm spiritual. It just means that I'm not really practicing my spirituality. Religion is just a more organized way of expressing belief in the supernatural, right? So sometimes it's going to church, sometimes it's small groups, those are religious identification with the fact that people are searching for something beyond themselves. But to say, oh, I'm spiritual, but I'm not religious, usually means I recognize that there's something greater than myself, but I'm not going to do much about it.
For the faithful and the religious, it's an important time of year, Easter, Passover, Ramadan. Do you have a message that you hope will reach people?
You know, as I'm a Catholic Christian, and I don't have to make up a message, and I'm grateful for that, because who am I to make up a message, right? In Christianity, this is Catholics, Anglicans, mainline Protestants, all believe that Easter is a celebration of the fact that God became man, lived everything that we've lived, experienced all the evil and suffering that we have lived, except for sin itself by Jesus, right? And then overcame that by taking on the suffering that would be due to us because of our own bad decisions, and died on the cross, and then rose again and overcame the darkness that overcame the earth. So the message to me is that in any situation that you're living right now, if you believe in Christian theology, and there's certainly elements within Islam and Judaism that mirror this, or at least play into this, what we believe as Christians is that no matter what situation you're in, God's love and mercy are so much bigger than that, and power are so much bigger than whatever we're suffering. And he will, if we allow him, we allow God, if we allow God to enter into our lives, he will make good out of the bad that we are suffering, even death and suffering. And that's why he died and rose again.
Theologian and Fox News contributor Jonathan Morris, thank you very much for your time.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Happy Easter.
And now, some good news with Tanya J. Powers.
A Florida bride-to-be has gone viral for sharing a text from her fiancé's father following her marriage proposal. Mia Amabile is a Miami-based content creator who recently got engaged to Alex Rudolph, a restaurateur who popped the question during a trip to St. Bart's. After the big moment, Mia says she pulled out her phone to find the text from Alex's father, Doug Rudolph, expressing his joy about the big event. It said, quote, "Now that it's official, I wanted to take a moment to directly and personally tell you how overjoyed we all are to have you become an official member of our family. We have loved you from the moment we met you and could always see that you and Alex were absolutely meant to be together forever." Doug went on to say, "We are so greatly looking forward to all of the amazing times we will get to spend together." Mia's TikTok post about the whole thing has almost 4 million views. And to make things even more special, the couple asked Doug to officiate at their wedding. Congratulations, Mia and Alex. Tanya J. Powers, Fox News.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
This week on Perino on Politics, are today's presidential candidates bad or good for American business? The host of Making Money on Fox Business, Charles Payne, joins me with a look at how President Biden is impacting business. Available now on Apple, Spotify, and FoxNewsPodcasts.com.
Subscribe to this podcast at FoxNewsPodcasts.com.
It's time for your Fox News commentary.
Robert Jeffress.
What's on your mind?
People who only attend church once a year usually choose Easter Sunday. It's ironic because this is the service where we celebrate the one claim about Christ that most people have difficulty really believing, his resurrection from the dead. In our culture, there's widespread acceptance of the fact that Jesus existed, that he taught nice things, and that he died on a Roman cross. But people stumble over the assertion that he rose from the dead 3 days after his execution. The resurrection of Jesus is often treated as a legend like Santa Claus. It's fun to play along pretending that it happened. Our cultural practice of Easter seems to be celebrate an old truth for a day, then live the rest of the year as if it's a myth. But this doesn't work. There are three reasons why Easter matters more than just one day a year. First, Easter matters because the resurrection is central to Christianity. In his letter to the Corinthian church, the Apostle Paul asks, "What if Christ were not raised from the dead?" Paul concludes preaching would be worthless, faith would be misplaced, and the dead would be lost forever. Without the truth of Easter, there is no salvaging of Christianity. It would be a dead religion that has spent 2,000 years duping people into wasting their lives. Second, Easter matters because the resurrection really happened. It's impossible to explain the tumultuous events of the first century if Christ did not rise from the dead. Weak disciples suddenly became bold witnesses of the resurrection. Hardened skeptics like Paul and Jesus' own half-brother James became so convinced of the resurrection that they gave their lives to tell others about it. Then, of course, there's the empty tomb. The corpse of Jesus has never been discovered, and no plausible natural explanation for this has ever been offered. Finally, Easter matters because one day you're going to die. I believe people are drawn to Easter because we all know deep down that death is coming for us one day. Like Job, we wonder, when I die, will I live again? Easter matters because it proclaims the truth that what we all inherently want is in fact possible. Because of what Christ has done, eternal life and unending joy are possible. This isn't based on wishful thinking, but on an empirical fact. Jesus Christ is alive. He conquered death just as he promised he would. And one day, those who trust in him will also enjoy eternal life. Jesus promised, "I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live, even if he dies." That's why Easter matters. That's why Easter will always matter. This is Robert Jeffress for Fox News.
You've been listening to the Fox News Rundown. And now, stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com. Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.